You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, we'll find out about what's new at this year's EAA Air Venture Show in Oshkosh.
First, the summer has been a particularly wet one here in Wisconsin. Storms that rolled through the state last week caused over $15 million in damage to public infrastructure, and Governor Scott Walker declared a state of emergency in 20 counties. The most affected areas are in the southwest, west central, and south central parts of the state, according to the Department of Natural Resources.
Jonathan Erdman joins us now to talk about why we've seen so much flooding and if we should expect it to continue. He's a senior meteorologist at weather.com. John, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thank you, Judith. You know, your timing is excellent because right outside my door right now, it is absolutely pouring. So couldn't have timed this any better.
So I think the big question is why? Why are we seeing so much flooding this year?
Well, you know, Wisconsin usually sits at the boundary between the really hot, humid air that you typically see, say, in Kansas and Nebraska and Missouri this time of year, and the cooler air that our friends up in the UP of Michigan and in Canada enjoy. And usually right along that boundary is where you get a lot of summer thunderstorms. And Wisconsin, unfortunately, has just been right in the bullseye of where those clusters of thunderstorms that meteorologists give a name called mesoscale convective systems. They just, one after another, come down through the Midwest. And unfortunately, over the last couple of weeks, they've nailed the same areas over and over again.
And you talked about kind of the dynamics that make it possible in Wisconsin, but are other parts of the region also kind of getting, are they on the edges of this and also seeing flooding?
Yeah, there's been some other areas over the last month or so that have been hit pretty hard. Parts of course, northern Illinois, into Indiana, Ohio, and into parts of the Northeast as well. Even yesterday, there was some pretty serious flooding in parts of the Northeast. So, you know, these patterns set up, and we see this in the summer quite often, not just in the Midwest, but in other parts of the country. When these patterns set up, they can be very persistent, where one area will get these thunderstorm clusters seemingly night after night, while other areas just, you know, maybe 100 miles north or 100 miles south won't see any rain at all. And then in the middle of summer, they actually can turn to drought. So unfortunately, southern and western Wisconsin has been right in the bullseye this time.
So is this a matter of the timing of it, or is it also a matter of the quantity? Is this more rain than usual, or is it just how and when it's fallen?
Yeah, it's much more rain than usual. You know, summers can be wet here, but really, again, western and southern Wisconsin has picked up anywhere between 6 to 12 inches of rain this month so far. You know, of course, maximum down right near the Mississippi River in Grant County, and then, of course, down in Kenosha County where Burlington had some serious flooding. So it's just been that strip. You know, you go up into parts of northern Wisconsin, they haven't seen nearly as much rainfall up towards, say, Tomahawk and Rhinelander and Eagle River. So it's been a very sharp boundary, but the areas that have gotten hit have gotten hit repeatedly.
And what types of damage have we seen so far from this season's flooding?
Well, it's a lot of residential damage on, you know, near rivers that, frankly, have not seen that kind of flooding before. Of course, we saw the flooding in Burlington, Wisconsin, along the, I believe it's the Fox River there, that hit a record crest there. And then, you know, we've seen some pretty serious flooding down in the Driftless area of southwest Wisconsin, particularly in Grant County, and then down in toward Darlington as well, you know, Pecatonica River and those areas. And then, of course, further north up toward La Crosse, there was some pretty serious flooding in parts of the city of La Crosse last week, and then up toward Buffalo and Trempealeau counties as well. So it's been that strip, basically along and south of I-94, if you can envision that, from Milwaukee, from south of Milwaukee all the way to up toward south of Eau Claire and Black River Falls. That's been the area that's been hardest hit.
We're talking with Jonathan Erdman right now. He's a senior meteorologist at weather.com, and we're discussing the flooding that has affected Wisconsin this season. Jonathan, are there any particular types of weather patterns happening right now, like an El Nino year or something similar, that is just making it that much more intense?
Well, you know, it's interesting. We just came off last spring the strongest El Nino we had on record, actually a record-tying one. But so far this year, there has been neither an El Nino nor a La Nina officially, and that's measured by ocean temperatures in the eastern equatorial Pacific Ocean. But when you look at the atmospheric response to those ocean temperatures, it still looks kind of like La Nina still. So what that generally means is we generally can get pretty wet here in Wisconsin. And in fact, you know, looking at the year so far through the first 6 months of the year, it was the second wettest year to date. In other words, January through June on record in 133 years. Only 2013 started out wetter than this year has started out in the state of Wisconsin. So, you know, it really hasn't been much of an influence from El Nino nor La Nina so far.
So we had a wet start to the year, too. Do you think that this really wet weather pattern is going to continue into the fall and maybe the winter and affect snow accumulation?
Well, there's not really a correlation to speak of regarding, you know, if we have a wet winter followed by a wet spring, you know, a wet summer, that doesn't necessarily translate to the fall. I was looking back in the records 4 years ago when we actually had a wetter start to the year, the only year we had a wetter start. And what was weird about that particular year is that by later July into August and September, it got very, very dry very quickly. So, you know, we can't really say what the rest of the year's precipitation is going to be, and it may not necessarily correlate to the wet start. We could easily, by the time we get into fall and we get those first cold fronts of the year, all of a sudden we could just turn dry, and the pattern could just flip on us. So we'll just have to stay tuned and see what comes up.
And do you think that this kind of flooding and extreme weather is a new norm for Wisconsin or for all of us?
Well, that's a good question. You know, the government released its climate assessment several years ago, and one of the big findings is, and you know, the climate science community is pretty vehement about this in the research, is that you know, we can't pin down any particular cluster of thunderstorms on any particular day and say, yep, that's climate change. You know, climate change doesn't cause individual weather events, but what it does do is it contributes to, in some cases, the severity of an event. And what the climate science community has found is that we are seeing an increasing number of heavy precipitation events. In the upper Midwest, since the 1950s, we're seeing about a 37% increase in these heavy rain days. And so what that means is we can expect, as the climate warms, and as, you know, warmer air, you generally have more water vapor in the air when the air warms. So the more water vapor you get in the air, the more the potential is for these heavy rain events to occur. So in other words, a day where you might just get a half inch of rain, maybe the changing climate is loading the dice a bit more, so you might see out of that similar event, you might see maybe an inch of rain, or, you know, 2 inches of rain becomes 3 inches of rain. So, you know, the changing climate is starting to load the dice toward an increased chance of these heavy precipitation events. And unfortunately, that means more flash floods like we've seen.
And Jonathan, as we wrap up, you know, there are rain events and there's flooding, and then it's not an immediate recovery from that. It takes time for water to recede and for the ground to be not as saturated. For the areas that have been so heavily affected in those 20 counties, especially that are under state of emergency for flooding, what kind of forecast can we expect in the coming days? Are they going to get a break?
Well, this is my favorite question so far because I actually have some good news. You know, we have this band of rain that's moving through right now, mainly in southern and southeast Wisconsin. That's moving out pretty quickly. And behind that, we're finally going to get some less warm, less humid air, and a much drier pattern looks like it's going to be setting up for at least the next 5 to 7 days. Really, the next good shot of rain for much of the state doesn't look to shape up until next Thursday. And so, you know, we might see a stray storm in northern Wisconsin this weekend here or there. So if you're heading up north camping or fishing or anything, you know, be on the lookout for that. But I think the heavy rain threat is finally going to leave us alone for a while, at least until the middle or latter part of next week.
Well, John, thanks for joining us, and thanks for that bit of good news there.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure.
That was Jonathan Erdman, senior meteorologist at weather.com, who is in fact based right here in Wisconsin. He joined us to talk about why there's been so much flooding in the state so far this summer.
Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
The tech field is known for being largely white and male. Winnie Karanja is trying to change that by teaching kids of color, especially girls, how to code through her group, Matem.
So I became interested in programming when I was in high school. I took a class and I was one of the two women in the class, and I was one of the two people of color in the class. It's hard to enter a field where you've never seen anybody look like you. So, I mean, my perception was the reality that I was seeing out there, right? I was just thinking, honestly, this is a space that for someone like me who loves to talk to people and socialize and interact, that I couldn't be in a space that was like a dark room where no one was social. And those are my perceptions. But I had these various experiences that showed me that actually it looks really different. I was really blessed to go to school in the UK, so I had a very different international scope of people who I did work with. The beauty of what we had in London, the beauty of what we had in these startup spaces where you had people from different life experiences, countries, people who had all diverse experiences really coming to the table and creating a product. And I was like, this is what we need, right? We need to hear these voices. We need to see how people are understanding products differently, how they're utilizing them, because that makes a better product. And so coming back and seeing like, oh my, you know, we need to do something. I was aware that the disparities existed. I just saw the need for that. I saw the need to start this conversation for young people and with young people and to start cultivating, I guess, this environment where everybody can feel like tech is a space that they belong in. They can start building products and start envisioning themselves in the field. And that's where it got me once I moved back to the Madison area to start Matem. And because when I was in high school, I didn't envision myself in the field. And so I want to be able to help others to do that. So we, our focus and our mission is to introduce girls and students of color to opportunities in the tech sector. We work with third graders all the way to 12th graders. We teach front-end web development. We're going to be stepping into some back-end development, mobile app development, touching on a few things around virtual reality and animations. We make our programs wide in that scope because students have a lot of different interests, and it's really key for us that students know that they can bring that creative side to tech, because a lot of students think, oh, you know, it's really analytical or it has this focus and I don't belong. And so we really want to shatter the I don't belong thought. We've had students who've built websites, you know, from their favorite sports players. So we've had websites on the Warriors, LeBron James. We've had a cooking blog. We've had a website around chocolate. When students have gotten together, started writing code, and you can just hear something like, I didn't realize it was that easy to write code. I think one thing that I didn't expect was just, I knew that there was a need, but the need that we have is so much greater than what I expected. Students that we work with are just brilliant. I mean, they're literally brilliant. And being able to just create a space where they can flourish and where they can have the skills to start dreaming ambitiously with tech, I'm like, I get to do this. I get to be a part of this. It's always so exciting, and I never take that for granted.
Winnie Karanja is the founder of Matem. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
Now, this week is the 2017 EAA Air Venture in Oshkosh. The event showcases aviation technology, living history, and cultural stories. This year's event commemorated the 75th anniversary of World War II's Doolittle Raid and the 70th anniversary of the U.S. Air Force. Meg Jones joins us now. She covers military and veterans issues for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Meg, great to have you back with us.
Nice to be here.
Well, you've been zeroing in this year, among other things, on veterans at the EAA Air Venture, and this year saw the 75th anniversary of the Doolittle Raid. Can you tell us a little bit about that part of World War II history?
Sure. The Doolittle Raid happened in April 1942. It was about 4 months after the Pearl Harbor attack, and America was reeling at that time. And it had lost a lot of its naval power, and the powers that be decided to do a very daring, very audacious raid and basically take the battle to the Japanese homeland. So what they did was they got 16 B-25 Mitchell bombers, which were named after Milwaukee native Billy Mitchell. And these bombers were designed to take off from airfields, not from the deck of an aircraft carrier. But they modified them, and they trained the pilots, who, by the way, did not know that they were going to Japan until they were at sea for 2 days. And they taught them how to take off from an aircraft carrier. So basically this, from the USS Hornet, is steaming toward Japan, and they wanted to get within around 400 miles of Japan because this is a one-way flight for these guys. They had enough fuel to get to Japan and then fly on to China or to Russia, where they would have to crash land their planes, but then hopefully survive the landings and then make it back to safety. But their carrier force was discovered by a Japanese fishing boat, and the Japanese fishing boat radioed ahead to the Japanese authorities. So they had to take off way earlier and much farther out. So, but all of them survived the bombings that they did in Japan, and then they crash landed in China and in Russia. Three guys died that night in the raid, and an additional four men were killed later by the Japanese. But most of them survived. And of the 60 men that flew on the Goodula raid, there's only one guy still alive. His name is Richard Cole, and he's 101 years old, and he spoke here today in Oshkosh. Hmm. And I must say, it was fabulous. It was a really, really cool thing because there was hundreds of people that just basically stood up and gave this guy a standing ovation and listened to him, you know, a living history person telling what it was like, what the Doolittle Raid was like. It was really, really cool.
Wow, that's really amazing. And tonight, actually, there's going to be a recreation of the takeoff of the Doolittle Raid. What are you expecting to see?
Well, so the B-25 bomber, there's only about 40 or 50 of them still flying. And about a dozen of them, I'm pretty sure I saw a dozen, are here. And they've come from all over the nation. And once the B-25 owners found out that AirVenture was going to be doing this homage to the Doolittle Raid, they all flew in. And it was really kind of cool because this morning they had all dozen of them parked nose to tail, like they were parked on the deck of the USS Hornet. So tonight, barring the weather, it's raining right now, but if it clears up, what they're going to be doing at the night air show is all 12 of those B-25 bombers are going to take off just like they did off the deck of the USS Hornet. So it should be really cool to see.
Wow, yeah, that's going to be a sight. And Meg, this year's EAA in Oshkosh is also marking the 70th anniversary of the Air Force and the 8th Air Force Bomb Group from World War II. Can you tell us a little about that?
Sure. There's been, they get 10,000 planes coming up here to Oshkosh, ranging from the latest technology to vintage biplanes and warbirds. But this year, amongst the warbirds, and a warbird is basically a military plane, and it can be from any country. They've got Russian planes and Canadian planes that were used during combat. But they've made a big emphasis on bombers. And what's really cool is they've got lots of the old bombers. There's B-25s, there's B-17s. There's the only two flying B-29 Superfortresses. Those are the huge planes that drop lots of bombs in Europe, and also the Enola Gay was the B-29, the plane that dropped the bombs in Japan. The atomic bombs in Japan. But then also what's cool is that they've got the latest bombers. So you can see a B-1 bomber, you can see a B-2 bomber. These are bombers that are now being flown by our American military forces. And it's cool because they've been doing what they call heritage flights. So they'll take up an old bomber and a new bomber and then a couple of chase planes, and it looks really, really cool.
And briefly, we've heard a lot about the historic aspects that can be seen at the EAA, but there's also something that definitely looks towards the future. There's a demo of a so-called flying car. What can you tell us about that, Meg?
Yeah, so there's actually a couple of companies that are trying to come up with a flying car. And And there have been flying cars before. I mean, there have been cars that have flown, but none that have been, you know, manufactured for large commercial use. But last night I went to a session by Uber, and they're coming up with a new program called Uber Elevate. And they're not actually building the planes, but they're working with aircraft companies to come up with basically, it's called vertical takeoff and landing, which sounds like a helicopter, but it's not a helicopter. And they said, we don't want helicopters because they're too loud and they're too noisy. But basically, they were saying that you'd be able to, and they're hoping to start flying testing in 3 years. And then by 2023, people will actually, instead of, you'd have your Uber app, but instead of pointing, you know, pushing a button that's got a car, you'll push a button that's got an airplane, and you'll basically book a flight like you would for like an Uber flight.
Wow.
And so there's a couple of car companies here. There's one called the Switchblade, which basically is the blades, like the wings, basically fold underneath the car like a switchblade, and it's basically like a motorcycle, but like a three-wheeled motorcycle. And they're also taking that. When I talked to the guy yesterday, he said, well, I've already gotten 58 people putting down money, you know, that they don't want to buy them. So the whole idea is that when you fly somewhere, you're kind of, you have to rent a car, or you're kind of stuck, or there's times when you're stuck in traffic in your car and you think, oh, wouldn't it be great just to, like, fly above all this?
Oh, yeah.
And that's kind of the whole idea why a flying car. So I don't know how much closer we are to the Jetsons than we were 5 or 10 years ago, but if you've got Uber getting involved in this, then there's some might behind it, because basically people don't like to sit in traffic, and they'll do anything they can to get to their destination a little bit quicker.
Well, Meg, thank you so much for joining us and telling us about the EAA this year.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
Meg Jones covers military and veterans issues for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, joined us to talk about this year's EAA Air Venture in Oshkosh. For more than 40 years, psychiatrists and other mental health professionals have followed the so-called Goldwater Rule. The rule, in essence, prohibited these professionals from openly speculating or diagnosing public figures like lawmakers with mental health disorders.
And there's a debate currently underway about whether the Goldwater Rule should be amended for our current political climate. Some psychologists have said that the rule is becoming more of a gag order that prevents them from participating in the public discourse, while others say that the ethics of the profession could be undermined by discarding the rule.
Sharon Begley joins us now. She's a senior science writer at Stat News, and she wrote about the Goldwater Rule this week. Sharon, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Well, Sharon, let's get a little background on the Goldwater Rule. What exactly is it?
It is named for Barry Goldwater, the senator from Arizona who ran for president in 1964. At the time, there was concern that he might be a little bit too enthusiastic about the nuclear option, and a magazine took it upon itself to poll a number of professionals in mental health, especially psychiatrists. It sent them a survey, and it asked basically, was Senator Goldwater mentally fit to serve as president? And the results were sort of 50-50, but it was regarded as scandalous at the time. And as a result, the American Psychiatric Association, the main professional group, in 1973, nine years later, adopted what's now called the Goldwater Rule, which, as you said, says that it is unethical for a member of the Psychiatric Association to publicly offer a professional opinion about someone's mental health who they have not examined.
And there was a lawsuit as part of this, wasn't there?
There was, and the publication lost. So the psychiatrists themselves were not sued; they were not involved in the lawsuit. But the publication was, and that caused people to sort of back away in fear from offering these public opinions about people's psyche.
Was there anything that you noticed, anything that would point to a particular political climate at the time that Barry Goldwater was running for president that created the special dynamics of what resulted in the Goldwater Rule?
Right. So this, of course, is going back a number of years, but one of the most famous ads during that campaign, and one that has remained as a, you know, sort of icon of political advertising, is the so-called Daisy ad. Of course, in 64, Senator Goldwater was running against incumbent President Lyndon Johnson. And again, because there was this sense that Goldwater might lead the country into nuclear war. President Johnson's campaign ran a TV ad in which a little girl was seen pulling, sort of doing a "he loves me, he loves me not" a thing on a daisy, pulling one petal off after another. And in the final frames, there was a mushroom cloud behind her. So it was deemed a very, very effective ad. Some pundits said that it sealed the election for Johnson, who, of course, won in a landslide. But that's emblematic of the kind of discussion that was going on at the time, that Goldwater was so mentally unstable that he would cause a nuclear war.
So after that story unfolded, how did mental health organizations respond? Was it sort of uniform that everyone moved to adopt this, or were there holdouts along the way?
There remain holdouts. The Goldwater Rule was adopted, as I said, in 1973 by the American Psychiatric Association, which now has roughly 35,000 members. It is the country's leading psychiatric association, at least by numbers. There are a number of other professional organizations in this country whose members diagnose and treat mental health and mental disorders. The American Psychological Association, not to get too deep in the weeds here, but psychologists generally do not have an MD. Psychiatry is a medical specialty. You first have to get an MD, and then you specialize in psychiatry. The American Psychoanalytic Association, which is the group in the news this week, a much smaller group. They consists of some psychiatrists, but also some social workers, some psychologists, and others. And then there's also the National Association of Social Workers, again, people who treat, who care for people with mental disorders. So of those big four, only the American Psychiatric Association has adopted and just this past March reaffirmed the Goldwater Rule.
And you published an article this week that caused quite a reaction. It looked at an email sent to members of the American Psychoanalytic Association. And to be clear, this organization, again, different from the American Psychiatric Association. What did that email say as you read it?
Right. So as we were just discussing, the other groups had not formally adopted the Goldwater Rule, but neither had they rejected it. So there had been a sort of implicit assumption that the Goldwater Rule applied to all mental health professionals. You would not be, you know, drummed out of your organization unless it was the American Psychiatric Association. Sorry, there are so many societies and associations running around here, but it was implicit that all mental health professionals would follow it. So what was notable about the psychoanalytic group's notice to members earlier this month was that they took it upon themselves to proactively say, keep in mind, we as an association have not adopted the Goldwater Rule. You are not bound by it, and we are just letting you know that. So what was interesting was it was, you know, as many of the experts described it to me, the first crack in what had been a monolithic wall in which professional groups told mental health professionals, do not comment on the psyche, on the mental health, on the mental state of public figures, unless, of course, you have examined them, in which there's patient confidentiality in play. So that crack in the wall was interesting, especially given the, you know, the times that we live in.
Now, the public affairs director of the American Psychoanalytic Association told National Public Radio that the organization hasn't really changed its stance. Its members were always, it says, able to comment on public figures, but have been cautioned against diagnosing them. That's the distinction they're making. So is there really any kind of shift here? Do you stand by the idea that there's a crack in this monolith?
I definitely do. And the reason is the Psychoanalytic Association could simply have continued on as it was. Again, they had not had the Goldwater Rule, but they took it upon themselves to send this memo, this email, to all of their members saying that, keep in mind, you are not bound by it. And that was a significant step, as it was described to me. One of the past presidents of the Psychoanalytic Association explained that they took the step because they believe that the value of psychoanalytic knowledge, as she put it, is important in explaining human behavior, and they do not want to prohibit their members from using that knowledge responsibly, from engaging, from participating in public discussions, and they felt that it was important to, again, remind their members that that was their stance.
And this Goldwater rule is at issue again, no matter how you read this email. There's a Dr. Leonard Glass who wrote in, he told the Psychiatric Times that this Goldwater rule has become even stricter since Donald Trump was elected to office. He says it prevents psychiatrists from offering not just diagnoses, but also offering opinions. And at least this doctor is pushing back against that, saying that this is psychiatrists are a resource in looking at public figures, and in this case, Donald Trump at stake. Do you think this is reigniting a kind of debate about the Goldwater rule?
It clearly is, and I did speak to Dr. Leonard Glass, who, as you said, publicly resigned from the American Psychiatric Association over the Goldwater rule. And as you just described him as saying, the association sort of doubled down on the rule this past March. It previously had said the prohibition is against offering a diagnosis of a mental disorder in a public figure, but it went further in saying you can't even comment on what you think might be behind a person's behavior, statements, etc. So that was an expansion of the rule at a time when some psychiatrists, I won't say many, we don't know how many there are, have been expressing their concerns about the rule. And I should insert that those concerns were raised long before Donald Trump announced his candidacy for the presidency, let alone before he was elected. So this is not linked to Trump solely. But again, by expanding what the Goldwater rule prohibits, the Psychiatric Association was, in the views of some members, imposing a gag order at a time when, you know, the behavior of public officials, including the president, raised questions in the public's mind. And that was another point that several psychiatrists and others brought up with me, that when a public figure is behaving in a way that raises eyebrows, that causes concerns, the public is eager for expert understanding, expert analysis of what might lie behind that behavior. And as Dr. Glass put it to me, by silencing psychiatrists and other mental health professionals, the rule robs the public of their professional judgment, prevents us from communicating our understanding of the president's mental state.
Sharon Begley is with us right now. She's a senior science writer for Stat News, and she's with us to talk about the Goldwater Rule and its place in the current political climate.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you think that psychologists should be able to comment or analyze public figures such as the president? Do you think people need to hear about potential psychological issues that could be affecting politicians? Or do you think that it stigmatizes people with mental health conditions? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up our conversation in just a bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and we're continuing the conversation about the Goldwater Rule. This is a rule that prohibits mental health professionals from commenting on the mental health status of public figures like the president or anyone else in lawmaking or other public spheres. Sharon Begley stays with us. She's a senior science writer for Stat News.
And you can join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234. What do you think of the Goldwater Rule? Do you think it's important for mental health professionals to abstain from diagnosing public figures? Or do you think that it can help the public? Do you think that this could stigmatize people who have mental health issues? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll take a caller now. We've got Charlie with us first in Milwaukee. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, thank you. No, the real question would be is how accurate does a psychiatrist or a psychologist feel they could be just by seeing someone's actions and voice or what have you from the TV. You know, they often say that Donald Trump in person is much different than the Donald Trump you see on TV, that he's an actor and that in real life or a real person, he's much more charming and more sane, so to speak. And I guess I would think of it like a dermatologist looking at a picture of someone. Can they reliably diagnose skin cancer just by looking at a photo? If so, that's one thing. It's another thing if, you know, seeing Donald Trump from just a few episodes on TV, is that really the picture that someone feels confident?
Charlie, thank you for that. Yeah, and I imagine that's exactly the terrain that the Goldwater rule is getting at, Sharon.
Exactly. So a couple of points about that. One is that psychiatry is the only medical specialty that has a rule like this. And I bring that up only because last week I also wrote about Senator John McCain's cancer diagnosis. And there it was no problem at all to get people to comment on what his prognosis might be, et cetera, always with the caveat that they were not the physicians on his case, but they would say things like someone with glioblastoma can expect this, that, or the other thing. So by analogy, what psychiatrists who oppose the Goldwater rule are arguing is that they should be permitted to say someone who behaves like this might be doing so for these psychological reasons. Very few of them are saying we should be allowed to sit here, you know, 2,000 miles away, watch someone on television and say, oh, yes, he has this defined psychiatric diagnosis. It's more that they would like to offer an informed opinion and even a hypothesis. They would like to be able to say, we think that this is what might be going on, you know, with all humility.
And let's get one more caller in here. Margie joins us next in Milwaukee, and thank you to Charlie as well. Margie, hi.
Hi. Good topic. And I strongly believe that mental health professionals should be able to give some insight because you have every other expert talking about everything. You have lawyers saying, well, I don't know about this particular situation, but this is what ethics can mean or this is what whatever can mean. And you talk about if someone famous has a colonoscopy or breast cancer, they're on there discussing in generality what breast cancer is and colonoscopy and things. And you can't treat mental health any differently. It's a medical issue, and if people have questions about somebody's bizarre behavior, why can't somebody that has an awareness of those kind of situations bring it into the discussion? Otherwise, you're ignoring it.
Margie, thank you so much. I appreciate you calling. And what about that point of view, Sharon, that this is very similar to other professions that comment all the time about public happenings and public figures?
Exactly. And no specialty, well, even medical specialties, as I said, no others have that prohibition. So just one other interesting fact, both the State Department and the CIA employ or consult with psychiatrists and ask them to offer their views, their insights, their analysis of the behaviors and the mental states of foreign figures, foreign leaders. So there's already the sort of stamp of approval from the federal government that this can be done, again, not perfectly, not definitively, but from afar, and that people who do it, who are experts in observing a public figure's behavior, do have something important to offer.
And we leave it there. Sharon, thanks a lot for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
Thank you all. Take care.
Sharon Begley is a senior science writer for Stat News, and she was with us there to talk about the Goldwater Rule, its history, and whether or not it should or could be changed in our current political climate. And you can let us know what you think about the Goldwater Rule prohibiting mental health professionals from diagnosing a public figure from afar. Let us know what you think. Should it stay in place, or is it time to move on? Let us know on the Central Time Facebook page.
Lakefront homeowners in Adams County are waging a war against the man who operates the dam that their lake depends on. As Glenn Moberger reports, the man who bought the dam in 1985 has been told that he might not even own it.
A thin 70-year-old man with a gray ponytail looks down at the water rushing through the gates of the Friendship Lake Dam.
Yeah, I bought this dam 35 years ago. It was a wreck. It cost me a fortune to fix it up. And these people say, well, yeah, you only paid $1,000 for it. It wasn't worth anything more than that.
Chuck Pfeiffer thinks his dam is worth a lot more than that now. He wants $1.2 million.
It is a valid price. Whether I would sell it to them for less would be out of the good graces of my heart.
The homeowners in the Friendship Lake District want to own the dam because they aren't happy with the way Pfeiffer has been running it. Bob Berry, the group's president, is balking at the price.
His reasoning and his logic for wanting that amount of money is ridiculous.
Barry walks down the steps of his manicured lawn to the lakeshore and points to his pier, which is high and dry. He blames Pfeiffer for lowering the water levels.
Mr. Pfeiffer will open the gates to drain the water down. Most of us residents, and it's my opinion, Phil, he's doing it just to kind of screw with us so we can't get our boats in. We can't enjoy the lake.
Pfeiffer admits that he has lowered the lake levels in the past few years.
The lake was lowered down, one, for safety reasons, and make the dam a hell of a lot more convenient to run for my purposes.
And he says he doesn't care if Bob Berry can get his boat in the water.
A lake that doesn't generate power and all it does is support high-speed motorboat racing out here with 200 horsepower boats, it really doesn't appeal to me at all.
Pfeiffer says he got into the dam business because of a lifelong fascination with green energy. In a small room above the spillway, a generator that he built converts the rushing water into hydroelectric power, which he sells back to the power company.
240,000 kilowatt hours a year.
But the dam may not be safe, according to the DNR. They sent a letter to Pfeiffer in the Village of Friendship demanding that steps be taken to address some problems, or they would drain the lake. The department also questions whether Pfeiffer actually owns the dam, because in 1985, the village didn't get a permit to sell it to him. Both the village and Pfeiffer think the sale was legal.
I do own this dam. Now, if I don't own it, then nobody owns anything.
Pfeiffer says he has done some of the required safety work, including a study known as a dam failure analysis, but he won't show it to the DNR.
Do you think I'm going to hand them a $17,000 dam failure analysis for free when they say I don't own it? I'd rather burn it.
The safety concerns came to a head on July 8th when torrential rains brought the lake level up to the top of the berm. Bob Berry was suddenly complaining about too much water.
Most of my pier sections and most of the neighbors' pier sections, the decking was all floating, scattered around the lake. My boat was all kittywampus.
When Pfeiffer arrived and opened the gates, it flooded Friendship Park. Berry says it shouldn't have happened.
In my opinion, it was negligent on his part for not keeping an eye on the levels of the lake.
Pfeiffer bristles at the charge.
Quite honestly, some people who don't know anything about what they're doing need to keep their mouths shut.
Now, the Lake District is trying to condemn the dam and take it from Pfeiffer for $110,000. The district secretary, Karen Picorni, says property values are falling.
They are not able to sell their homes. As a Lake District, we have the right to do this. And the right is for the greater good.
Chuck Pfeiffer says he's worried about his property.
They're greedy to get something for free.
They claim that what you're doing is hurting their property values.
I bet it is. And quite honestly, they're the people with the keys and the purse that can rectify it within 5 minutes.
The ownership dispute and the effort to take the dam are in the hands of the attorneys. In the meantime, there is precious little Friendship on Friendship Lake. Glenn Moberg, Wisconsin Public Radio News.